Now, frequent strife among the Merovingians, Merovingian rulers in each of these three sub-kingdoms, led to increasing dominance by powerful aristocratic families. Slowly but surely, those aristocratic families gathered to themselves more power, more influence, more wealth, more authority, more followers than even the royal family itself had. The greatest, the most powerful, the most successful of these aristocratic families is the one we know as Carolingian. And it was that family that produced Charlemagne. We will take up Charlemagne in our next lecture. But the point is that we have the Franks on a successful trajectory in the lands over which they ruled. Let's say just a very quick word about the rest of the British Isles. Ireland's political evolution was embryonic in this very early period. There were dozens of tiny little kingdoms on the island, no movement yet towards coherent political development. And the same is true of Scotland and of Wales in this period. We'll encounter these areas in later lectures when they began to achieve something like political cohesion. But in the period that we're concerned with, there really has not yet been any effective cohesion in these realms. The same is true of the Slavic lands of Eastern Europe, and the same is true of the Scandinavian realms to the north. In the period 500 to 750, roughly, it is the Frankish and the Anglo-Saxon worlds that attract our attention. The second great development of this period is the elaboration of the Catholic Church across Western Europe, the Christianization of Europe. Now, in Rome, the popes slowly but surely turned away from the Mediterranean world and entered into relationships with the emerging political leaders of these Western realms that we've been talking about. After all, the people in the East were always bothering them on dogmatic grounds. They were always demanding taxes in Italy, for example, that would be spent fighting in the Balkans or indeed in Anatolia along the eastern frontier. The popes were not particularly keen on any of those things. And the popes began then to turn to the parties of Western Europe, a very important, a very fateful, a very significant step, rich with consequences for the future. The popes also continued to build their institutional leadership in central Italy. It is in these years, really from the late 7th across the early years of the 8th century, that the papal state, the ancestor of Vatican City, begins to come into being. And we find the odd situation of the leader of, a church being simultaneously a head of state. Popes became very important patrons of art, patrons of learning, in and around the city of Rome, building glorious buildings, attracting scholars to the city of Rome, playing, in other words, some of the roles that the Roman Church has played throughout its history. Elsewhere in Western Europe, and we've seen this point earlier, bishops remained very important local leaders. In each of these kingdoms, bishops became important leaders. Now, much was inherited from the Roman past. Indeed, many cities survived precisely because they had a bishop. Cities vanished if they didn't get a bishop. But in our period, 500 to 750 thereabouts, the most interesting thing is not the persistence of the old bishops' cities, but the growth of new bishops' cities. For example, in England, a whole host of cities emerged, but Canterbury in the south and York in the north as their leaders. In the Frankish world, it was the lands to the east of the Rhine that were significant. Those were areas that lay outside the Roman Empire and now were being folded into the system, as it were, by the work of missionaries, by the work of kings, and by the work of other churchmen. Bishops were beginning to be come together in church councils to meet, to legislate for the church. It's very interesting to note that whole kingdoms worth of bishops gathered together to meet, to talk, to discuss, sometimes, to be sure, under the leadership and aegis of kings, sometimes on their own initiative. But however that may be, however the leadership question may play out, the church was coming together to rule, to organize, to legislate, long before kings could actually do this. Long before there were unified kingdoms, there were unified churches within kingdoms. Bishops became key advisors to kings. Now, this was rich with consequences. Sure, it brought the prestige, it brought the wealth, it brought the learning of the church to the advantage of kings. But it also meant that bishops, insofar as they had kings' ears, could talk to them, could advise them, could direct the way they would rule, to suggest to them that their royal office was not military, was not social, was not political, but was a kind of a divinely conferred ministerium, an office of responsibility that they held on behalf of God and in service to God's people.